This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government. This is Dr. Jonathan Abel. I'm here with Dr. Bill Nance.
Hello.
And we're going to talk about probably an undercovered but very important aspect of militaries and military history, and that's professionalism. Dr. Nance has just written a book on William Simpson, one of the leading but under-recognized generals of World War II, which is kind of the genesis of this idea. So we're going to kind of switch our hosting hats as we talk about each other's periods. And what it means to be a professional in those time periods. So we'll start with you, Dr. Nance. What does it mean to be an Army professional, a U.S. Army professional in any era?
And, of course, that's something that we have written books about, and it really all depends on kind of who you ask. There are the characteristics of a profession. It's self-policing. It has standards of conduct. There is some sort of credentialing mechanism that comes in there. These are kind of the modern definitions.
Well, you've done it. So what does it mean to you to be a professional?
And then on that note is it is somebody who upholds the standards that come with it, that you're in it not just as a job. This is a part of who you are. You don't have to completely, wholly buy into the system and all the parts of that system, because part of being a professional is also recognizing that your profession has got some problems with it. It's got some holes, it's got some challenges, but rather than throwing that out and not being a part and not wanting to be a part of that system, instead you're actually doing something actively to help fix it, make that profession better, make that system better. And so when you see like the difference between somebody who just does this for a job, they're there for the paycheck, they're there 9 to 5, they might do a really great job while they're there, but then they put it to the side and they don't come back to it. Whereas a professional is somebody who is sitting there and they're actively thinking about, how do I make this system better? How do I make this organization better? It is part of who they are. That's why you see like a medical doctor. You know, it's not just, oh, I'm a doctor 9 to 5 and I put it away on the weekends. Or, oh, I'm a lawyer and I just put it away on the weekends. Well, perhaps maybe a lawyer, but...
Yeah, I get what you're saying. It sounds like we can kind of settle on this. A modern professional is somebody... to borrow from Catholic social teaching, who sees their job as a vocation, maybe even a part of their identity, if we want to get into identity kind of history.
But no, also, I'd agree with that.
Also somebody who, as you mentioned, might be a partisan but not a fanatic.
Yeah, it's like, and the idea being, what I tell people all the time is like, if you're not thinking about how to make your organization or the thing that you are a part of better, it means you don't care.
Yeah.
It's not, oh, I'm happy, oh, everything's perfect, all that kind of stuff, because nothing's perfect. If you're not waking up every day thinking, how could I do this a little bit better? How could I be more efficient? Then it means you don't care. You're just not trying. You could be putting more into it.
Which is a definition that can cover anybody from, you know, a drill press operator to a very white collar, as you mentioned, like a medical doctor type of job. Yeah, okay. Good. So let's start at the end of the story, at the end of your story. It's late 1944. There are 3 Allied army groups spread across Europe. It's the largest army America has ever produced. It's over 8 million people in uniform. There are army group commanders, there are army commanders, there are corps commanders, and we can get as detailed as we want, but a lot of general officers. Where do those general officers come from?
Okay, these general officers are, for the most part, Let me clarify. American general officers.
Yeah.
These American general officers are, for the most part, there are a couple exceptions. Mm-hmm. Courtney Hodges of the U.S. First Army being one of them. West Point products. Courtney Hodges actually started in West Point, failed out due to mathematics. Interesting side story. That was the same mathematics course that nearly took out William Simpson of the Ninth Army and turned back George Patton of the Third Army, so that he actually ended up doing two plebe years. So math is a hard subject.
So this is the weed out class that everybody runs into who's been to college.
Apparently so. At least for these gentlemen, math was hard. But okay. I digress.
So these guys, by and large, are West Pointers.
These are almost all West Pointers. And what's interesting is that these are all West Pointers, about plus or minus five or so year groups. And again, I'm being squishy because we're dealing with large numbers of folks. But as a for instance, the West Point class of 1909, or people that are year group that would have been in that year group, includes George Patton, William Simpson, J.C.H. Lee, who's the commander of the communication zone, the logistics guys back there, Hodges of the First Army, and Jake Devers of the Sixth Army Group. So that's five of the four Army. Of the armies plus the army groups that are out there.
Yeah, and we're talking a minimum of, what, 15 stars among those men in 1944?
Oh, criminy, yeah, easily. Yeah. And so what you're seeing is it's mostly West Pointers, and those that aren't have some connection to West Point in most cases. Mm-hmm. And these are long service professionals. Again, I mentioned West Point class in 1909. Again, quick beer math, 1909, 1919, 29, 39. These guys are gentlemen with an average of over 30 years of service under their belt by the time they're commanding.
Which makes sense in a bureaucratic institutional army like the U.S. Army in 1944. They're people who have punched their tickets at every level, even if that was for a short time.
Right. Now, what's fascinating about most of these gentlemen is most of these gentlemen... Okay, in the United States Army of 2023, or later, a general off, it's like you would have made general well before your 34th year of service. That said, most of these gentlemen made brigadier general right around 1940, right at the massive expansion of the Army. So these gentlemen had stuck with the Army through its lean years. They had been and seen the Army. Most of them spent the interwar years as field grade officers, spending many, oftentimes up to a decade at the same rank.
Right.
Doing various and sundry jobs in the Army, because the Army wasn't promoting them, but it had need of them doing all these different things.
Right, which makes sense for a peacetime Army in an era of austerity.
Right. These guys are doing things from commanding battalions to leading ROTC detachments, which we can talk about in a minute.
Devers at Fort Sill in the artillery.
Right. Simpson, who's an infantry officer, he does a stint as an ROTC instructor. He does. Many of them spend a substantial amount of time as instructors. Yeah. The Army, the interwar Army, American interwar Army, placed great store in instructor time in professional military education. So if you look at these guys, there is a substantial record of people who were in first students and then instructors at like the infantry school, the cavalry school, the artillery school.
And Devers helps create the armor branch.
Yes,
as well.
Exactly. Yeah. But then also teaching at the Command General Staff College, teaching at the Industrial College of the Armed Forces.
At West Point.
Teaching at West Point.
Right.
Teaching at the War College. And also, for many of them, also service on what was commonly called kind of the general staff. It wasn't always known by that name, but it's basically what we would consider today to be the Department of the Army.
Yeah.
It was the Pentagon before there was the Pentagon.
Right.
These are the working in office buildings running the bureaucracy of the Army. So these guys had done a fairly wide variety of troop assignments, what we'd today call institutional Army assignments, and then as well as staff assignments as well. So these
guys are both deep and broad in their experience.
Yes. Okay. And they all know each other.
Right.
This is a very small, when you really come down to it, this is a fairly small organization of folks. West Point's not producing a lot of officers every year. As you may have mentioned, it's a period of austerity. People are getting out. People are getting sick, whatever the reason may be. In a particular year group, you kind of know, if not well, but you kind of know everybody around you.
So let's dive into that in a little bit of detail. First of all, these are all commissioned officers. What does a commission mean in the U.S. military?
Okay, in the United States military, well, really in most militaries, a commission means you are receiving a commission from the government. In the United States, we receive our commission from the president. And the president of the United States having reposed special trust and confidence in the patriotism, valor, and fidelity and ability of whatever.
So a U.S. Army officer holds a physical piece of paper.
Right.
You
receive a piece of paper from the president that says you hold a rank, and whenever you're promoted, you get a new commission for that.
Right.
Now, to break that down into older Army terms, there were things like regular commissions and then reserve commissions. There were more details, but we can deal with those as they come across. And West Pointers received regular Army commissions. Mm-hmm. Because the idea being is they were considered agents of the government. And as a commissioned officer in the regular Army, you were a agent of the United States government acting on behalf of the president for the federal government.
Well, we think of officer as being somebody in the military, but an officer by definition is somebody who holds a government office.
Correct. Particularly in the early years of the Republic, commissioned officers did a lot of different things. They engaged in minor forms of diplomacy. They worked with trade.
Sometimes they opened stores in the West.
Did all sorts of things. I mean, when you take a look at the fact of when Dewey entered the Tokyo Harbor, I believe, he was acting on behalf of the United States government, but he wasn't getting on a satellite phone and calling the president and saying, hey, is this right? He's acting on behalf of the president.
Yeah, and then you get into questions of plenipotentiary power. And with the Navy, it's often complex.
And we can go into your in just a second. I just want to finish this thought real quick.
Yeah.
Is with a regular Army commission, is the United States, from a very kind of early ages, we kind of had the regular Army, which was considered the professionals, the people that do this for a living.
Those are going to be the generals when the war starts.
Right. And this is, now it starts to become West Pointers more and more throughout the 19th century.
Okay, so you've got, let's wrap this thought up. You've got regular, you've got reserve, and then there's the state militias, which become the National Guard.
Right.
Which is a separate.
And what you receive is you receive a commission in the reserves. And now, again, we're kind of mixing our terminology right now between kind of modern and older. But it works for our purposes right now. Which is the reserve commission is somebody like, I need somebody to be an officer because the Army is expanding.
Yeah. So you're let's say, a shop owner in peacetime, but when the war comes, then you put on your colonel's hat.
Right, and you go off and do things. And then when the war is done, you're expected to go back and be a shop owner.
Yeah, and the Guard is tricky because traditionally the Guard is literally the state militia.
Right.
But in the early 20th century, it becomes part of the official Army.
Right. National Defense Act of, I believe, 1916, it federalizes the state guards into the state militias into the National Guard. But up until that point, you would receive your commission from the state.
State governor as opposed to president.
And then when they become federalized and work under federal service, I believe there is some transition period there. And there's also some wonkiness, right? Like you can hold several commissions simultaneously. Like during the Civil War, there's a cases of guys that would graduate from West Point, receive a commission in the regular Army as a second lieutenant, but then the state of Pennsylvania needed a colonel of infantry. So the state of Pennsylvania, with the blessing of the War Department at the time, would offer the second lieutenant straight out of West Point a commission as a colonel of infantry in Pennsylvania Volunteers.
Right.
And then at the end of the war, that commission, of course, goes away, and now he reverts to whatever rank the regular army wishes to bestow upon
him. And you can also have a confusing situation where the state grants somebody a rank that's not recognized by the army. I believe a famous example of that, if I'm remembering correctly, is Colonel Sanders of KFC fame, who was a colonel in the Kentucky militia, but I don't think ever held an official army.
I don't believe so. Yeah.
So, okay, so now we've talked about commissioning sources, or commissions, so let's talk about commissioning sources, right? So you've got West Point, you mentioned ROTC. So what's the difference, and what is ROTC compared to West Point?
Okay, so let's kind of back it up a little bit prior to that. So in the 19th century, the way you generally received a commission was either from the federal government through West Point, the regular army, or you received it in a state militia that then might be recognized by the federal government in times of national emergency.
And that might be one of the other military academies like a VMI or Citadel.
Those are the famous ones, and then there's also just sometimes when a state's raising a militia, you're a prominent citizen.
Yeah.
You
donated to somebody's campaign. Congratulations.
Here's some birds. You're a colonel.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how it starts out, and as we start to kind of formalize this system.
Professionalize it.
Correct. And it becomes people that are now, this is their calling, this is what they do. You basically end up with a regular army, which will come from West Point, the officer corps, I should say. The officer corps will generally come from West Point. You have some people that are going to commission through the ranks, and they're going to receive direct commissions that way. Mm-hmm. They're not very common, but they do exist. And then you have guys that will receive reserve commissions. And the idea behind it is, it's in the name, is you're going to go be a civilian, but if I need you, you're going to come on to active duty and serve a role.
So this is ROTC, right? Reserve
Correct.
Officer Training Corps?
And it's in the name, right? Reserve Officer Training Corps. And the idea being is that, and it comes about, I believe, the same National Defense Act of 1916, which creates this. It might be a little bit later.
Yeah, I don't think it's really put into practice in peacetime until the interwar years.
Yeah, it really kind of gets its start in the 20s and kind of picks up steam in the 30s. But the idea being is that the U.S. Army is looking at it going, if we're fighting a major conflict, LISCO, large-scale combat operation, to use modern terminology, we're going to need more officers than what West Point can produce.
Like the over 8 million we have in 1944.
Right. So what we're going to end up doing is that we need a bunch of people who have some training and the ability to put on a uniform as they need it.
So basically what you're saying is we take somebody, we train them as, let's say, a major, and then they're going to go be a middle manager at a car company.
Yes, but we won't train him as a major. We'll train him as a junior officer.
So we're talking lower ranks.
Correct. Okay. We're talking, we're going to train this guy to go out and be a lieutenant.
So the idea behind ROTC is not to train generals.
No. Okay. The idea is that if a war kicks off, I'm going to need a lot of lieutenants. Mm-hmm. And the lieutenants that I currently have in the regular army, I'm going to rapidly promote them to make a... to fill the higher levels. The idea being is the ROTC, the reserve officers, are going to come up and fill the lower echelon.
Right, what we call company grade officers.
Right, and then the regular officers.
The company grades become the field grades.
Right, now we're still talking regular army. The National Guard is its own separate thing that we'll set aside for a moment.
Right. Because it does answer to states.
Correct, and there is a separate promotion system in place that goes for that category.
Right, which is still, I think in this period, fair to say, is still somewhat beholden to the older idea of yes, you need to be a professional, but also you may know the governor.
Right. There's more of that coming into play, and it's really going to show up in the mobilization for World War II.
Yeah.
But the idea being is that then you enter this other concept of the United States Army will provide the regulars for there, and then we will create what was called an Army of the United States. And the idea being is that, okay, we're talking about a mass mobilization, so I'm going to call up the reservists. Mm-hmm. So those ROTC officers that were, you know, car salesmen in Dayton, Ohio.
They are now Captain Smith.
They're actually going to start as Lieutenant Smith, serving as a platoon leader in a company. Well, all those guys that were lieutenants, captains, majors in the regular army, well, that's not enough of them. So what I need to do is I need to very rapidly promote these guys. But I expect that after the war, I don't need the, I'm not going to need the rank structure that's going to come with this quite as quickly. So I give them a second commission in the Army of the United States. And this is where these guys get very rapidly promoted.
So this is the equivalent of a brevet rank.
Correct.
A brevet traditionally is, it's a battlefield promotion where you say, hey, for this campaign, you're permanently a lieutenant, but for this campaign, you're going to be a major.
Right. And in this particular case, like you take Simpson. So Simpson gets promoted brigadier general in the regular army, you know, I want to say 1941. And what he does is that that's his permanent rank.
Right.
But then, well, he needs to be a division commander. Well, rather than go through the process of expanding the regular army, Congress has to do both.
Yeah.
But it's easier to promote someone in the Army of the United States because the expectation is that that's going to go away after the current crisis.
So I think a good example of this in a prior war is George Custer,
right?
Who I believe his permanent rank was never higher than lieutenant colonel, but he's wearing two stars as a brevet rank during the Civil War.
Correct. And we see this pretty frequently throughout American military history. This is because American military history is rife with, you have a small regular army, and we enter into a large war, and we need to rapidly expand.
Right. So let's talk about another commissioning source that you touched on earlier. Walk us a little bit through the idea of OCS.
Okay, so you have OCS is Officer Candidate School. The idea is, and it's become much more formalized throughout the years, but the idea is that you take high-quality soldiers who exhibit leadership potential.
And so we're talking enlisted folks.
Correct. Soldiers who enlist as opposed to receive a commission. Mm-hmm. There is a difference there, which is why when you get to see NCOs, they're non-commissioned officers. They are an officer holding an office, but they do not hold a commission from the President of the United States to serve as his direct representative.
Right.
That's the
right
legal definition, but there's other things.
Yeah.
They also just do different tasks. But as you take a look at it, so you take a soldier or an NCO who has received, you know, typically they've got some sort of schooling under their belt, all that kind of stuff. And we try and get them when they're younger because you don't want to get somebody that's well advanced in their career because you're trying to get something more out of them. Doesn't always happen.
Right. So the idea here is you're identifying, let's maybe a sergeant who you think could be a good platoon leader.
Right. And have potential beyond, because you don't want just a platoon leader. Because in peacetime, you want someone that's going to maybe go on and progress onward. So you take this person, and then you send him to a school, and we've kind of put him through a training process. It's a mixture of boot camp and officer training. So in the morning, you're treating them like privates, and you're beating you're not beating on them, but you're putting them through all the marching and the drill and all that kind of stuff. And in the afternoon, you're teaching them things that lieutenants need to know: land navigation, how to call for fire, how to counsel soldiers, how to small unit tactics. And then at the end of it, and the time length varies dramatically depending on what period you're talking about, also in terms of how quickly we need them. Right. In Vietnam, we needed officers very, very quickly, so OCS shortened dramatically.
Right.
During the recent global war on terror, we didn't shorten OCS, to my knowledge, too much, but what we did is we added an additional company in the OCS training program so we could produce more officers quickly.
Yeah, so we didn't shorten the time, but we expanded the room size.
Right, and the difference being on the war on terror is that what we did not do in that particular case is we did not, you know, do this vast mobilization where now we have a bunch of citizen soldiers who are all kind of coming in just for the duration and then going to get out. We kept the professional army. And how we increased the size is, one, we increased the size of the professional army, so we had to recruit more officers. We had to assess more officers, recruit more soldiers, assess more officers. Mm-hmm. So part of that was making OCS bigger.
Right.
And then we also would then activated the Guard and the Organized Reserve to then go be to fill in for that as well.
Yeah, and GWAT is in many ways kind of a unicorn with all this stuff.
Right. Yeah. Most of the long wars, you talk about the wars against natives in the 19th century, it was just the regular army carrying the burden of that by itself.
Yeah.
Plus augmented every now and then by state militia, yeah, but for local things.
All right, so we covered the bureaucracy of the American Army. Let's kind of switch this, and we'll talk about what this looks like in the prior period, and then do some comparison.
Okay. So officers, okay, we got ROTC, we got OCS, we got West Point.
Yeah.
Let's jump to France. Well, you can pick a date, but I'll say call around 1700. How do you become an officer in the French army?
Yeah, then? that's an interesting question. One of the reasons I specifically ask you about the commission is, I'm going to push that forward a little bit so we're not in the middle of a war.
Okay, fair enough.
1700, there's a war, right. So once we get into the era of Louis XV, it's after 1715, and there's actually a long peacetime. Basically, there's not a major war until 1733. You become an officer by buying a unit. And this is probably the single greatest difference between the modern bureaucratic professional army and the army of the 18th century. And this is true for any army in the 18th century. Officer positions were what were called venal. You bought them from the government. What you did was you paid the government a certain amount of money to receive the royal commission. And there is actually a commissioning document. You know, the government, the king says, you are the proprietor of, you know, let's say the first regiment from Auxerre, to pick a random French place. Now, often the units would take on the name of the owner. So that's why you see the unit lineages are really hard, because they change names. So like there are two units of light horse that Maurice de Saxe raised, they were called the Saxe units, right? So probably Saxe regiments.
So you could own multiple units simultaneously.
Yes. Now, by and large, the units that are bought and sold are companies and regiments, understanding that both of those tended to be administrative and not tactical units.
Now, if I remember correctly, and this actually goes through the American Army all the way through the Civil War, is the battalion is an ad hoc tactical formation that you would kind of create on the fly. The standard, what you lived in, was your company, which belonged to a regiment.
Yeah, so it's a little more formal in the French system. The battalion is an enumerated unit. It's not ad hoc like it might have been in the early American experience. So when you read a list of units, they're usually listed by regiment, but they also list the number of battalions, because battalions did not have a standard number of regiments before the end of the century. Regiments didn't have a standard number of battalions before the end of the century. So they would list like the 1st Nivernois Regiment with 4 battalions, and then however many men were in the battalions.
What was their standard number of companies per battalion?
It varied widely. As you might imagine, this is a proprietary army, so before the middle of the century, there are no regulations for this stuff. So there might be, you generally would want 8 companies per regiment, whether that was in 2 or 4 battalions, and you can do the math for how that would work. It was very much an army that was at the behest of the owner.
So I could see a battalion. So one battalion might have 2 companies, and the company and the battalion right next to it in the regiment might have 4.
Right, and you have the problem too. It's a pre-modern problem, but you see echoes of it in the present. The problem of empty roles, right? So your regiment, the 1st Nantes Regiment, might have 4 battalions, but if those battalions are half strength, you have 2 battalions.
Which gets to the question of, okay, so I bought this regiment.
Yep.
It's my regiment. So where do my junior officers come from? So I'm assuming that the company commanders are buying their positions from me?
So this is kind of an interesting aspect of how this is done. The commission must still come from the royal government. But to think of it in a modern context, let's say you bought a regiment. So this is the 1st Nantes Regiment. Now, given your age, you're around 40, you would not buy a regiment
generous
for yourself. You would buy a regiment for your son. So you would have your own regiment that you had, actually your father had probably bought for you. And you're a good case for this, because you're from a line of officers.
Mm-hmm.
So your father would have bought you your regiment when you turned 13. And then you would have bought one for each of your sons when they turned 13. So in this case, you would have your own regiment that you maintain, and then you would have another regiment in your house.
A brigade of Nantes.
Yes, exactly. That's the idea of how it would work. So the officers within your unit, now there's two ways you can do this. One way is, do you have the confidence that you can lead your unit into battle? You probably do. What about your son, who is currently...
The youngest is 13.
Okay.
So you picked a good age.
Your youngest son, do you trust him to command a regiment in battle?
Probably not.
Okay. So what you do then is you go to an existing officer and you say, I need an experienced colonel to run this regiment. So your son is the colonel proprietor. He owns it.
Mm-hmm.
The colonel commandant runs it.
Now, where does that colonel commandant come from?
It can come from anywhere. Usually what you would do is, so in your case, you are a moneyed person, and you're mm-hmm. titled because you have, you know, you have to be a member of the nobility to
okay.
do this. You would go to somebody probably from your home region who doesn't have money but has a title. They probably have been in the military just as long as you have. So you would say, hey, you know, count of this estate that makes no money, here's a commission for you in my regiment. You're now the colonel commandant.
Okay, so this person may have been serving in other capacities because nobles generally
yes.
were in the army.
Yes.
But in order for him to maintain a status of his current status, he would maybe have a purchased commission but not a unit.
Yes, or better yet, you would buy his commission for him.
So therefore he owes me
right.
more.
Right. And so you can see how there are these dual tracks developing. This is where, as you go lower, you get to poorer and less able to rise nobles. So your lieutenants and captains are a mix of people who are 16 and people who are 45. And you can guess where on the social and economic ladder they lie.
And when you're almost seeing, and to kind of take this to the next level, so you're lower... I don't want to say lower class, but your lower levels of nobles are actually the most experienced because they're the ones that are being paid to do the jobs
yes.
that the more moneyed guys really don't want to do or are unable to do.
So a very interesting shift takes place, and it's interesting that you said lower class because this is one of the big problems.
Yeah.
Increasingly, the people buying the commissions are new nobles. They're what are called anoblie, or Robin is the term you see in French a lot. So unlike in England, where the monarch throws a sword at you and you're automatically a noble, in France, you don't become a noble for a couple generations. You may have the title, but you're not part of the club. So in your case, you're a third generation officer. You would be fully accepted as a noble. Although if your nobility didn't date back before 1400, you're still not like a real noble, right? Is one of the many arcanities of France. So you would be kind of in the mid-tier. Solid noble,
yeah.
but still not old noble.
Right.
Increasingly, your companies would be purchased by people who had the noble patent themselves and who were merchants who were on the make, right? They're on their way up, but it's a pretty hard floor to get through. And so you have a dual track of officers where you have long-serving poor nobles who their life is to serve the crown,
mm-hmm.
and you have the sons of merchants who want to enter the upper classes, but all they have is money, right? So you have a social divide happening. Now, what happens towards the end of the century, so as you get in the 1760s, as our listeners might be imagining, this is a fundamentally irrational system by the time you get to the 18th century.
At this point, you know, you've got units of varying sizes, you have...
Right. So what the government says is, hey, we just lost a war, the Seven Years' War. We got to fix this. And look at the Prussians. They do this right. So what they do after 1760 is, in particular, there's a minister named Choiseul who does a lot of this. Okay, we're not going to sell units anymore. Now the government is going to issue the commission. The War Department is going to decide who gets those. And instead of you, Colonel Nance, funding your unit, which is the way it used to work, you paid for all the uniforms, all the training, you paid the salaries. Now the government's going to pay all that. So now we create a more professional system. And one of the really interesting things about professionalism in this period is there's different strains of it, right?
Well, if I'm reading it properly then, so then the commissioning process is about the same, which is if I want to be a colonel, if I'm a lieutenant colonel and I want to be a colonel, I go to the crown and say, here, and basically, here's my 500 gold pieces, or here are my 500 francs, and I upgrade my commission.
Yeah, the interesting thing is, though, well, two interesting points. One, lieutenant colonel is not an office.
Which I realize is,
But more interestingly and more importantly, there was no rank structure you had to work your way through. It was entirely possible that by the time you reached the rank of captain, and they recognized that to be a captain, you had to be skilled. You had to know how to put a company into maneuvers and into battalion drill, right? And the senior captain became the major who trained all of the companies. But above that, it wasn't that you were saying to the king, because he issued all the commissions, you weren't saying to the king, I have been a good major, make me a colonel. You were saying, my son is my son. He has never held a rank. Make him a colonel. And that was true even after the reform.
Okay.
There is no progress through the ranks once you get past captain.
But how do you get to captain?
You get to captain by starting as essentially a trainee officer. There's different terms for it. One of the things you, one of them you see commonly is...
And this is after the reforms.
Well, this is throughout.
Okay.
One of the terms you see frequently is anspesad.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically a cadet officer. So you put the cadet, who may be as young as 10, in the unit, and they learn how to do it. Because remember, there's no schools.
So take young, generic...
Right.
Noble at this point.
Yes.
At that point, so in either before or after the reforms... Goes as a cadet, serves as a runner, learns how learns kind of the ropes, kind of on the job training.
That's exactly what it is.
And is promoted from sub. I'm going to use British ranks because that's what I've had Sharp's rifle stuck in my head at this particular moment in time. Yeah. But goes from subaltern to maybe picks up lieutenant, and then is promoted to captain. And that is done, if not through merit, at least through kind of experience backed up by some...
It's fair to say that most captains, yes, you had to be noble for the most part. About 8% of captains were not noble.
Okay.
They were what were called roturier. But you had to be a noble. France has plenty of nobles, so it's not an issue. But you also had to have tested experience. If you could not maneuver your company as a captain in closed rank drill, you would not keep your job.
Okay. So
You might keep the title and the pension, but you wouldn't keep your job.
So what we can basically assume then is every French officer above the rank of captain is at least a good company commander, or was at the time when he got promoted.
See,
past
this
that.
This is the pre-modern versus the modern bias. It's opposite. It's inverted. Every officer below the rank of colonel is a competent commander. Once you get to the rank of colonel, then you're into the question of court favor, right? And the higher you go, the less you can assume competence. In many ways, it's the inverse of a modern professional bureaucracy, that at least in theory, the higher you go, the more tested experience and merit you have.
So to connect this with our World War II interwar example, so you have this general that's been in the army for 40 years, has proven competence at every level up until that point, and has now been entrusted with the command of an army or an army group because he's the most capable person that we can find for the job.
Mm-hmm.
In the 18th century French army, that works up until colonel. And then when they're now in command of a French army, that might just be the guy that was the court favorite.
Yeah, and this is a really interesting aspect of it. It's not uncommon to find 55-year-old captains in the French Royal Army. In fact, that's ideal, because you can't get much more tested experience than a 55-year-old captain, right? Being commanded by a marshal who is 30. And when you get into the command ranks, when you get into the ranks of what we would recognize as general officers, then you're really into court politics. One of the most important aspects of professionalism at the time is nobility. And this is where we get into really parsing the definition of what makes a professional, right? There's a myth we have of the pre-revolutionary era that people were promoted based solely on their nobility, and heredity does not confer merit. That's not the way they saw it. They saw it as being that heredity conferred the ultimate merit. Remember, this is a society structured by birth, right? There's no real social rising once you get past the very lowest classes. Like, you can be born a beggar and become a merchant, but you can't be born a beggar and become a noble. Not in France. You can do it in other noble systems, but not in France. So to them, to be a noble meant you automatically merited. Now, there's responsibilities that come with that too. So this is where you're getting into the, when you define professionalism as the stewardship of your profession. To be a noble meant you trained your sons in school, but also in war. And so when you talk about nobles as officers, they are the people who are schooled at doing it. Because when you, now Colonel Nance, go to war, your sons are with you. Because you ultimately, your job is to fight and die for the king. And when that's your job, your sons learn that. From the time they're old enough to listen to you, you tell them your job is to serve the king.
Okay.
So it's a different kind of professionalism, but it almost ends up at the same place.
Now, the question then becomes, American Army isn't perhaps the best example, because we tend to have very small echelons until suddenly we need very large echelons.
Which is not so the 18th century French army worked the same way.
Mm-hmm.
There is no peacetime army. What they do is, in peacetime, the army goes away and the permanent units are assigned to garrison duty on the frontiers of the kingdom. And the premier garrison commanders at Metz, which is a fortress on the northeast of France. So the Metz commander has a big garrison, maybe 40,000. That's the core of the army. So in the same way that you scale the U.S. Army for World War II, when the French have to fight an army, they take the garrisons, they pull them in to being the field armies, and then they build out the manpower, but not the officers, because the officers are already in place.
And they're just going to fill into those categories.
Yes. But they're not necessarily going to go up.
Okay. As opposed to the American Army, where you take a guy that was, famously, Eisenhower was a lieutenant colonel in the late 30s and is a five-star general by 1945.
Right. In that same instance, that person at best could hope to be a colonel.
Right. So in the French system you're talking about, the equivalent would be a marshal of some category.
Yeah, and so once we get into the general officer ranks, then it gets really complicated. Because it's not just a question of nobility at that point. Everybody is a noble by definition. I'm not aware of an early modern French commander who was a commoner.
Yeah.
Right? There are bastard nobles like Maurice de Saxe, but they're still nobles.
But the guy that would be the marshal of the French army going out to fight, he would have already held that rank.
Well, interestingly, not necessarily.
Okay.
And one of the reasons I'm parsing this is, once you get past colonel, there is no formal rank structure. By definition, a lieutenant general, and this is where you get into the confusion in the American army, right? Mm-hmm. Where a major outranks a lieutenant, but a lieutenant general outranks a major general. The reason for that is, technically, in the 18th century French army, all generals are lieutenant generals because they are the king's lieutenants. He dispatches them to command his armies. Where you start getting into problems is, one, the bureaucratic requirements have increased. This medieval structure they have is no longer sufficient. And two, nobles often refuse to be commanded by other nobles that they see as being beneath their status. So the position of marshal is created to solve this problem. Marshal is not a rank. We often confuse that. A marshal's baton is the equivalent of a 7-star general's rank, because they have stars up through 5 stars, which is a colonel general in the French service, and then there's this idea of an army commander would be a 6-star equivalent. And they also have a marshal general, which is an 8-star equivalent. But a marshal is a court honor that the king gives to a noble that says he can command all of the other nobles. He is trumped in command only by the person of the king. The real problem is what are called the princes of the blood. So there are lots of people related to the French king. Those are the princes of the blood. If you're the king's let's say, nephew, are you really going to submit to some random provincial noble being commander over you? And the idea was the princes of the blood should be the commanders, right?
You're right.
So you get into the situation where the king often has to adjudicate questions of nobility. And sometimes, like Louis XV is notorious, Louis XIV tended to defer to nobility, up to the point where it hurt him. So he appoints one of his sons to command an army, one of his grandsons to command an army. It's a disaster.
Yeah.
Louis XV says, no, I need good commanders. So he says to his own princes of the blood, if you don't play ball, I'm going to fire you. And he does.
Oh, wow.
So that's how you get somebody like a Maurice, low-ranking noble, commanding armies.
Now, I want to take this a step further, because we've been talking about operations and kind of battlefield performance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about some of the more technical branches, because this is part of the profession is being an expert in your field, that is part of the description.
Mm-hmm.
So tactics, I won't say they're easy, but they're fairly straightforward. I'm going to use my infantry this way, I'm going to use my cavalry this way, artillery.
Mm-hmm.
In the United States Army, when we look at our professional officers, we expect them to grow in professional expertise. A lieutenant, I expect to manage a platoon, his platoon, and maybe have some experience at a company level. Yep. By the time you're a lieutenant colonel or a colonel, you're not only expected to be an expert in managing a battalion and below, but that also means all the logistics, all the technical aspects. You're not necessarily an expert in all that, but you are at least passable enough that you can execute it. And then we actually have professional logisticians,
right,
professional administration, like our adjutant general corps. How did that work in the French Army when these are technicians that you need professionals in those categories?
Right.
And when you reach a certain level, you need to be kind of, if not expert in, capable in all those different areas.
No, that's a great question, and it ties directly back into the social milieu of the time. We have this idea, and it's largely promoted by the French Revolution when it was getting rid of nobility, that nobles are just these people who kind of sit around in their estates and they live off the unearned labor of their underlings. But the reality was, at least within the military, nobles, by and large in France, saw themselves as being the servants of the state, and that meant in the military. Now, not all of them were militarily inclined.
Yeah.
Some of them might go into the magistracy, but that was less common in the 18th century.
So that was really their job.
Yes. And so they saw themselves as being engaged in what we would recognize as a profession. So there are plenty of nobles who have committed themselves to studying things like logistics. And by the time you get to the 18th century, we're in the heart of the Enlightenment, right? So anybody who wanted to have a military career as a noble understood, you have to know what you're doing. You have to know, yes, you got to know drill, what we would call close order drill. That's how you did tactics back then.
Yeah.
But you also had to know how to command an army. The science of what at the time they referred to as grand tactics, what we would now recognize as operations. And there's a big debate about this. There's a debate about whether people are born like this or whether they're created, kind of the naturalist versus environmentalist idea. And what they're doing is they are creating themselves. So I'll give you an example for somebody I study. Guibert, who's the mid to late 18th century theorist, his father was an officer, what we call a staff officer. He's inclined towards paperwork and bureaucracy, his father is.
Now, is that something that he's inclined to, so he deliberately kind of chose that path, and this is how I will serve the king?
Yes.
And the army?
Yes. So in his off time, and they had a lot of off time back then, because fighting was kind of cyclical, right? You didn't fight much in the winter. So in his off time, he would build a box of the battles he'd been in for his son, who was the theorist, Guibert. And he would walk him through these, what we would recognize as kind of a hybrid between a war game and a sand table. And I've not found an earlier example of this in France. I think some Germans were doing some stuff similar. So he saw it as being his job not just to take his son to war, which he did, but also to teach him the technical aspects of the trade, right? And the whole point of doing a sand table exercise is to have that kinetic association with how you handle formations.
So this is a system that when it works, it can work very well.
Yes.
But it has the problem of the state doesn't really have a formalized system for how do I make sure that my generals are good logisticians.
Right. And so what they do is they recognize that some branches require a floor, a technical floor, in particular artillery and engineering. So they create schools for artillerists and engineers. And the engineering one is actually kind of attached to the architecture one. The bridges and roads ministry is a very important one in 18th century France. And interestingly, they have no problem allowing commoners to go to those schools because they recognize the technical sides of war are important, but also are things that nobles are not traditionally good at. Nobles don't get much of an education in math or ballistics, right? So that's when you reach down and you pull the commoners or the kind of people of questionable nobility.
Say from Corsica.
Like from Corsica, right? You pull them into the schools, like the artillery school, the engineering school. There's also a move to create academies. Now, these are not, this is not a West Point style academy. These are like high schools for people who are going into the military. So they create a central one in 1750. In the 1770s, they break it out into regional schools. These are for the poor nobles who can't afford a good education for their sons. They send their sons to these schools, and then they go straight into the army. And so what we're starting to see is the sense of professionalism is tied to social constructs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Nobles die for the king. They owe the king their military service. That is becoming, in the 18th century, a more bureaucratic army. Same values, same people, but the nobles are the ones who are leading the charge to become a more modern profession.
And what's interesting is that you point that out. It's like the idea of personal responsibility, the fact that I owe this. Now, take away king and substitute constitution or the nation.
Or just the state.
And no, well, I was talking the United States in particular, is that's what you have now in the American officer corps, is that same basic idea. It's just we've swapped who it is and we swapped how we select for that because we don't have a nobility.
Well, one of the really interesting aspects of the French army at the time, too, was there's a whole other part of it.
Mm-hmm.
About 20% of the French army was what they called foreign units. These were units largely imported from other countries. Now, there were some, like the Irish or Scottish units, that were kind of exiles in France. But in particular, the German and the Swiss units. These were people whose job it was to be soldiers. They had the formal rank structures. They had the internal education systems. They were the best soldiers in France.
Now, what rank structure did that go up to?
That went up, so the regiments. So that went up to colonel. And the reason the French maintain these, yes, there's tradition, but the practical reason was they looked to these units and said, hey, we know the Prussians are really good at drill. They're doing new things. You guys find out, train yourselves, then come train us. Those are the ultimate professionals. They are, by definition, mercenaries, but it's their job.
And the equivalent, not perfect, would basically be this is what we would do in today the regular army, call the regular army.
Yes. Imagine if the entirety of the U.S. military were mobilized. Regular army, reserve, National Guard. They're not foreign units, but the regular army is expected to be the paragons for the rest of it.
Some National Guardsmen might object, but we'll call that good.
And the National Guard is in an interesting place because the National Guard wears two hats, right? In wartime, they fight, but in peacetime, they do things like fill sandbags for natural disasters. It's an interesting kind of dual
And this purpose. Is where we see the difference, right? So when France mobilizes, the officer corps all is the same group of people that all come from the same category.
Yes.
Whereas in the United States, when it mobilizes, say we were to mobilize the Guard for, like, say, World War II, as we did, is the Guard officer corps, who in many cases came from some of the same commissioning sources that the regular army did, in many cases, although not always.
Right.
But they'd have been serving in the Guard, which were considered part-time soldiers, and you can see the air quotes, but part-time soldiers. when we start mobilizing and the National Guard is a substantial portion of the total army,
mm-hmm.
we didn't call it then, but that's what it is. The regular army looks at the Guard officers and says, I don't think you're good enough to command in combat. And so what you're seeing is that there's this massive purge of National Guard officers starting in about 1939, going really through the famous Louisiana maneuvers. And Marshall is cleaning house. I believe there's maybe one National Guard division commander out of, I want to say, 16. I'm a little off on numbers. I don't have notes in front of me. That actually gets to command his division in combat.
Let's talk about the social aspect here, because this is something I wanted to come back to. You mentioned that there's all these different commissioning sources, and you have this kind of, at least in theory, a democratic army, right? And yet, the military maintains an aristocracy, where there's a lot of people who are the children of prior officers, and you have what is sometimes referred to as the West Point Mafia.
And the West Point Mafia was much stronger in the 30s than it is today.
Right.
You just have to look at the senior echelons of the U.S. military. That has changed over time, and I think for the better, to be quite honest.
Well, and one of the things, too, that you see in the pre-war American society is, yes, you had to go to West Point to gain stars, pretty much across the board, but you also had to participate in society. You had to do things like play polo.
Well, right. Now, you want to be careful with taking that too far, because polo was actually... One, it's a fun game, right? Well, if you enjoy polo. But also what it is that throughout the 20s and the 30s, you actually had a significant number of people on horses, and like the cavalry.
Right.
And polo is a good way of actually training horsemanship as we go through there. I say this to push back every now and then. The people sit like, oh, well, they're just playing polo and they're... Yes, but there's a reason for that.
So what I'm doing there is the same thing people often tar the noble officer for.
Yes.
Which is, this is just play and it's exclusionary when there is a practical side to it.
Exactly. But to kind of get to your point, though, is that in the interwar, kind of the early 20th century United States Army, the expectation was is the regulars, a.k.a. the West Pointers, in 90% or better of the cases, they're going to be in the Army for the long term. So those are the guys looked at with favor to get the promotions, to get the plum assignments. Now, promotions at that time was done by seniority. Everyone in the Army was ranked by their data rank. Even the West Pointers were ranked by their position in the class.
Right.
So the number one student in the class, when they graduated, outranked the guy at the bottom of the class. So that was how you were ranked by seniority. And when there was a spot that came open and you had the right seniority, you were the next one in the shoot, and up you went one rank.
Right.
There wasn't such a thing really as centralized promotion boards. Now, what you could do is, you would get breveted, to use your terminology, as you went up. Take Simpson as an example. When the Army is authorized more slots, you get promoted quicker, right?
Right.
He is a second lieutenant, first lieutenant, and is a from 1909 to 1916-17. World War I comes along. He's finally promoted to captain. He's been in the Army by that point 8 years. He's finally made it to captain. As a point of reference, I was promoted to captain in less than 4 years in the Army. We were making him fast during the early days of the Global War on Terror.
Right.
He then, by the end of 1918, he's a lieutenant colonel in the Army Army of the United States. It's not that terminology, but it was what the equivalent was in World War I.
Right.
Because that's what he needed to be.
Right.
So what you see with these guys is that, again, you look at the West Pointers because they're the guys that are going to be they're the professionals, they're the long-term guys. The ROTC guys are I hesitate to use the term hired help, but I can't think of a better one right now. But that was often how many West Pointers kind of viewed their ROTC guys. Hey, it's great that you're here. Go command your unit of citizen soldiers.
Be happy commanding your platoon or...
And then once the war's over, you're expected to fade back into...
Right. While we West Pointers continue our...
Right. Now, there's a shift in the latter half of the 20th century where that becomes less and less prevalent because we need a larger commissioned army. And then what we realize is that there are the other the commissioning sources are producing not superior to West Point necessarily, but they're producing very good products, and West Point's producing very good products. So we you'd start to see democratization of the process even throughout.
Well, let's talk about that social aspect a little bit in both armies. So in my case, it's pretty much a closed system of nobles and people who are kind of around the edges of nobility. There is very little thought to including people who might traditionally be excluded because it's a caste system, right? Now, you do have a rare occasion where you do, like, there are probably a few officers of color in that army, particularly in the colonies, because there's a colonial army as well.
Yeah.
There's never any thought to having a woman be involved in this because, with rare exceptions, women simply were not educated in the 18th century. Not saying it's right, that's the way it was. But let's talk about the elephant in the room for the World War II army, which is you have an immense need, right? You need good people to command your army. We can quibble over whether or not we should allow women to do that because, again, a lot of the same problem, lower education,
attainment.
The real elephant in the room is Black Americans.
Okay, well, handle the women just because it's an interesting point. We stand up what was called the Women's Army Corps.
Right.
And then the women got promoted through that system. Generally, there were some male officers there. I'm not an expert in the Women's Army Corps.
Not officially in the Army, though.
Not the regular Army as we would understand the term.
Yes,
But now the African Americans. There were some African American officers that came through. Very, very limited number. There was actually a barracks at West Point, General Robinson, I believe so. This guy has suffered through a substantial amount to gain rank as he went through. Very, very limited number. Where you really start to see the shift is in the 50s and the 60s, where you see the integration of the armed forces through Truman's executive order.
Right.
And then you see African Americans start to get integrated into West Point. They also start to get integrated through the ROTC. And it's a slow process because you kind of have to get them into the system, if that makes sense.
Well, even if the Army has the best of intentions, which in fairness, most of the time it does, you're still fighting a society that in many parts does not want this to happen.
And what you have, and it takes time. And this is not something I'm a subject matter expert in. But as you sit there, it's like but what you do is you bring them into the West Point program, you bring them into the ROTC program, and what that does is that builds more and more momentum as people are like, oh, I worked with this guy, and it takes time. Women, the same deal. One of the best things that, in my opinion, that West Point did was it brought women in as plebes or freshmen, for those unfamiliar with the term, and they went through all 4 years of the program. Now, it was really rough for the women of the class of 80. There are any number of books that are on the topic, and more should be written.
Yeah.
I actually had the honor of meeting a couple of them that are of those first group that came through.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason they came in as freshmen is that they went through the whole process the same as any male officer did.
And the importance there, particularly for modern listeners to understand, is one of the many arguments against including basically non-white males was a competence argument, that these people were not here because they can't function. And by putting, in this case, female officers through the full process, you showed that that argument was silly.
Right, and it was the same thing with African-American soldiers. Now, that had actually been happening throughout the history of the country. I think Henry Austin Flipper is the first African-American graduate and had exceptionally rough time. And then there was a long period where there weren't any.
Yeah.
And then we started to develop more and more. This is a long process as we went through there.
Social
and this
change
is,
doesn't happen overnight.
Right. And this is actually one of the things that I think is kind of a superior approach to it is that the United States actually has the ability to, as society adapts, its officer corps can adapt.
Well, and one of the things that's also happening is, you know, we're focusing on two obvious subaltern groups, women and Black Americans, but there's also the question of the poor, right? Because if you want a truly democratic army, your officers can't just be coming from the scions of noble houses, the former officers.
And this is actually something now, you could argue West Point does a good job of it, you could argue West Point does a bad job of it. It's across the board, right? But what West Point did is that it brought the officers from across the nation. In fact, its appointment system is set up to guarantee across the states. So you've got that going for you, right?
It's basically the Electoral College.
And what you also see as a category is that different congressmen and different senators are going to run things differently. Dwight Eisenhower came from a small podunk town in Abilene, Kansas.
Right.
And
not the scion of a noble house.
No, not at all.
Not a MacArthur.
Not a Patton.
Yeah.
So this is one of those interesting things where you see West Point is this weird mix of, yes, you have the old army families and the rich families that send their sons and eventually daughters there. Yes, that happens. But you also, because of the way it's set up, they pull in the other, they pull in other categories of people as well. And then when you add in the ROTC program and the OCS program, what you're now pulling is you're now pulling from all parts of society, and it becomes a very meritocratic system.
Yeah.
Where now what you're seeing is that, and this is what I'm saying, is the West Point Protective Association is becoming less and less important the higher in rank you go, because we are now pulling from multiple different sources, and at a certain point, excellence becomes its own name of the game.
Right, right.
Interesting fun fact, and you see this in how the, we actually provide commissions. You talked about the King providing commissions. When I graduated from West Point in 2002, I received a reserve commission from West Point. And that was because about, I'm hazy on the exact times, about 10, 15 years prior to that, a lot of the Army had sat there and said, hey, it's not fair that West Pointers receive a regular Army commission, because now when you're doing RIFs, the people with reserve commissions go away. Quick story, my grandfather had been a lieutenant colonel in the United States Army Reserves at the end of World War II and at the end of Korea. He'd gotten out after the end of World War II, came back in during the Korean War. Yeah,
not uncommon.
But when they were doing the major rifts in the 1950s, they said, thank you for your service. Your service is no longer required. He's like, I'm very close to retirement. They said, we don't care. You've got 5 years. We don't care.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you for your service. But you hold a commission in the reserve. So he enlisted in the regular Army as a senior NCO, served out the remainder of his time to retirement, and then retired at the highest rank held. So on the day of his retirement, he scraped off the non-commissioned officer sticker on his car and put the officer sticker on and retired not as Master Sergeant Stuart Van Slyke, but as Lieutenant Colonel Stuart Van Slyke.
Yeah.
And in the 90s, people said, that's not very fair that the West, like, that the West Pointers had that. So everyone received a reserve commission, and then you received a regular commission, I believe it was when you made major. Now, that's gone away entirely, and now anybody who receives a commission in the United States Army, through whatever source, receives a regular Army commission.
So, ROTC is now kind of just ROTC, not the Reserve Officer Training Corps.
Yes, although we still call it The difference being is that ROTC cadets are not necessarily guaranteed a seat in the active duty Army. Due to our current accession troubles, I think that if you want a spot in the regular Army, it's certainly there for you.
Right.
But you can go into the reserves of the National Guard from ROTC as
Which is the same as my poor nobles who must serve the king in the military but don't always have the money to buy a unit, right?
Yeah.
So I think for me the takeaway of all of this is a couple things. One, the definition of profession is relative. It's relative to time and context, and especially to society. We often miss the social ties. And two, I think a really interesting question to ask in any time of any military society is who merits and what's the measure of merit, right? We often look back at the past and say, oh, well, nobles merit just because they're nobles, but that's not the way they thought of it. You know, the nobles tend to be better educated, they're closer to the crown, all of those things.
And right? I would argue not just they thought that, I would argue that generally society as a whole.
Yeah.
As a whole.
Yeah. Yeah, so those are kind of my two takeaways. What are yours?
No, to me it's interesting that as we kind of parse through this is that the end result, what we're striving for is the same thing, which is to put the best person in command of the of an organization at the moment of need. Mm-hmm. Now, what we have seen is how you get that person has varied over time, even in the United States Army. Mm-hmm. In 1930, the expectation was that the person in command of the Army at that moment of need was going to be typically a West Point officer of 30 to 40 years experience in the military.
Yeah.
Who would then step up to command the Army.
Whereas in my period, it's the person who is closest to the king, who has the king's confidence, whether the marshal's baton or the blood.
And in the modern United States military, in the 2020s, it's now a serving professional officer who's been in the Army approximately 20 to 30 years, who has led successfully and commanded successfully at every echelon from lieutenant up to his current her current rank.
Who's walked through the ranks.
Correct. And I do have to emphasize his or her, because we're seeing more and more women up in the general officer ranks.
Yeah.
Because in a general officer career of 20 to 30 years, West Point class of 1980 just retired at 20 years in 2000.
Right.
Which is not that long ago, and you see more and more start to come up in the system.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's good. It's been a good discussion, and I think there's plenty more of a lot of interest here. So for my side, in particular, I'd like to mention one historian. His name is David Bien, who wrote a lot about merit and professionalism in the 18th century officer corps, kind of exploded these myths we have about nobility. So if people are interested in that, I would suggest reading that. And I would also, I don't know that he would mention it, but I would suggest that Dr. Nance's newest book on Simpson is perhaps something worth reading too. So Dr. Nance, thank you.
Thank you much.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.